Hey guys, thanks for tuning in for another author interview from Books in the City. We are literally so excited to share with you this chat with Kate Quinn.
Yeah, so if you guys listened to the episode where I covered The Rose Code, you'll know that we both loved this book. I absolutely adored it. I did not want it to end, and it's so long too. I was like, it's not enough.
Yeah.
So just the fact that we got to chat to Kate about it was so, so awesome. She is so well-spoken, so intelligent. I forgot we were doing an interview at some points. I was just like, I feel like I was at like a lecture or something, like just listening to all this cool info. It was so great.
Yeah, in the best way, like not a boring school lecture, but like a really, really fun historical deep dive.
Like I would like pay money to go. Yeah,
it was really great. We're so excited for you to hear it. She is the author of The Rose Code, which we're talking about today, as well as The Huntress, The Alice Network, and a bunch of other really cool books, too. So make sure you check it out. Enjoy this chat with Kate Quinn.
This is going to be the best book you ever read. Like, this is your new favorite book.
Off the internet, man. Off the Bookstagram.
I need to go be introvert.
Welcome to Books in the City Pod.
Hey, guys. Welcome to Books in the City. I'm Kayla.
I'm Becky.
And I'm Kate Quinn.
I'm like starstruck right now, honestly. We are so excited to have you here. The Alice Network introduced me to historical fiction. Now that's my favorite genre. And The Rose Code was actually my most anticipated read of 2021. Lived up to the hype. I absolutely adored this book. So can you give our listeners a quick elevator pitch of what it's about?
Well, I'm so glad you enjoyed it, first of all. And for anyone who's listening, The Rose Code tells the story of three very different women, a beautiful blue-blooded debutante, a tart-tongued London shop girl, and a shy crossword puzzle-solving spinster, who are all recruited to the mysterious Bletchley Park, which is a secluded English country manor where the best and brightest minds in Britain work in direst secrecy, breaking Hitler's supposedly unbreakable military codes.
Amazing. I agree with Kayla. This is one of my favorite books of the year for sure. And the year's just gotten started. So that's really exciting.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Of course. So what inspired you to write about Bletchley Park?
Well, I've been fascinated with Bletchley Park ever since I first heard about it. The whole idea of a country house manor full of code breakers, you know, all, you know, just locked up together, you know, cracking the uncrackable codes. I mean, you really can't get more interesting than that. And I really think that my fascination with code breakers is a little bit universal, because otherwise there wouldn't be so many movies where there's the scene where either it's the hero or maybe the hero's brainiac, you know, the Brainiac's team member who suddenly is like staring at a wall or a chalkboard, and they suddenly sweep all the papers off the desk or sweep all the, you know, the signs off the wall, and they start scribbling madly. And something that has been just flummoxing everyone is suddenly made perfectly clear, just as we all, you know, watch in wonder. And I think we all have a little bit of a fascination with this idea that there are some kinds of brains that just have the ability, you know, when working very hard, to be able to turn chaos into light, as it were. And I love the idea, therefore, of, you know, writing about Bletchley Park. And the more I dug into it, you know, it's like, this is an incredible achievement of World War II. You know, some historians, you know, even estimate that without the codebreakers of Bletchley Park, the war goes on for another 2 years and millions of lives. And so when I learned that not only about that sort of statistic, but the fact that by the end of the war, about 3/4 of the code breakers were women. Well, that really fascinated me, because I felt like I had heard some of the male stories, you know, these titanic figures like Alan Turing, but I had not heard so much about the women. And so I really wanted to write a story about women, about friendship, and about what their experience was in this deeply intellectual war that was fought in incredible privacy in the middle of nowhere in Buckinghamshire in World War II.
It's so interesting you mentioned Alan Turing, because I love the movie The Imitation Game, and I kept thinking about that as I was reading this. And it's so interesting because there really weren't that many women in that movie, but like now learning through this book, so many women were at Bletchley. So did you get to visit, and what was that like if you did?
I did go to Bletchley Park for 4 or 5 magical days in pre-lockdown when I was able to go to the UK on a driving tour with my husband. And I spent about 4 days there just, and I could have spent a month. And the wonderful thing about it is that Bletchley Park has become an incredible historic visitor center. And not only can you go to the mansion and you can see demonstrations of what an Enigma machine does and how does it work, but you can also go into these little green Nissen huts that were thrown up all on over the grounds, all around the mansion itself, where so much of the code breaking was actually done. And when you walk into these huts, they've been mocked up to look like the code breakers have just stepped out to lunch for a moment in 1942. So you will see, 1940s era hats and coats hanging on the wall. You will see 1940s era cigarettes and, bottles of, soda pop on the table. You will see 1940s era, pencils and typewriters and people leaving notes to each other back to the canteen, back in a jiff, you really do feel like you're walking into the past. It was such an incredible experience. I really encourage anyone who is planning a trip for when the world reopens to go.
That sounds amazing. Kayla, let's add that to our list.
Yeah. Podcast field trip.
Yes. Kind of going off of that, we always love to hear about the research that goes into writing historical novels. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research process? How long did you research? How long did it take to write?
I think on and off, I was researching this book for about 4 years. It was probably the most complicated subject I have ever had to research for writing a historical novel. And that really is because I don't know why someone like me, who was not even remotely technological or mathy, decided to write about an intensely technological and mathy subject like code breaking, but I did. I thought it was a great idea at some point at probably 3 a.m. And so therefore, I read so many books about Enigma, the Enigma machine, the Polish codebreakers who made the initial breaks into Enigma in the 30s, about the start of Bletchley Park, about how the intelligence is disguised and used. I read, biographies and autobiographies and memoirs of the men and women who actually worked there, which were published decades later. I read books about the social life and the everyday life of Bletchley Park and what it was like to live in Britain in the war, when you were living under ration laws and all kinds of secrecy oaths. And I could keep reading. There are hundreds of novels and hundreds of books and nonfiction as well about this particular period and all of this work. And I think I could have kept reading forever, to be honest, because nothing I read ever made me quite convinced I knew how to break an Enigma code. My heroines know how to do it, but it didn't matter how many books I read or how many YouTube videos I watched where some cherry-cheeked Brit is saying, to really, really code breaking is absolutely terribly simple. You just, button up the bigram tables and then you find the settable umkrvelts. And I'm just sitting there going, that is not simple, Nigel. That is not simple even remotely. And I don't care how many times you tell me it is. So I walked away from all of this with a lot of information about the park itself and a huge respect for the men and women who could actually break Enigma and absolutely no faith that I could do it myself, but I could write a book about it and I could tell you what it felt like to break codes, even if I can't do it myself, which is what I tend to think of as that's the job of a historical novelist. I don't need to teach you as the reader how to break codes. I just need to tell you, how does it feel to break codes? And that at least I felt like I was qualified to do at the end of 4 years of research.
And you completely pulled it off, because I'm not a math person either, and I would reread some of those passages to try to really figure it out, but I loved sharing in their celebration when they finally got it. So what was the most interesting thing that you learned about Bletchley Park itself?
Well, I was really fascinated not just by the work that they did, but the fact that they had this lively social life that went on, and just how much these incredibly bright people were, they worked hard, but they also played hard, and they, in a way, they had to, because this is a very different kind of war that was being fought here than the kind of war that was fought by anyone who was in service on front lines. Because the people at Bletchley Park were incredibly safe. You know, they were in the middle of Buckinghamshire. They were never targeted by bombing raids. They were not in physical danger. And just by the fact that they knew about Bletchley Park and worked there meant that they would never be sent into any kind of active zone as either a soldier or a spy or anything like that, simply because no one could take the risk that they could be captured and then forced to tell what they knew. So that just by working at Bletchley meant you were physically safe for the entire war. And yet there was an incredible mental and emotional toll on these people. It was incredibly stressful, hard work for one thing, you know, emotional breakdown, burnout, paranoia, insomnia, you name it, they suffered it. And so there was very much a sense that when they were off the clock, they, you know, tried as hard as they could to, you know, be able to blow off a little steam. So you had, you know, a tennis club that propped up. You had a cinema club. You had Highland dancing going on the lawn in front of the mansion. You had, you know, you had codebreakers who were sunbathing on the side lawn. And apparently a lot of the ladies in Hut 6 had to go, oh, I didn't see that, when they went around the corner and saw a little more than they should have. And that was the kind of thing that I really loved, because, you know, the park really springs to life as a place that was with a very vibrant culture, and a very vibrant culture, moreover, that was accepting, because this was a place where they recruited a lot of oddballs. And I think it was because they realized a lot of the people who are good at code breaking can be, they can actually go all the way to neurodivergent, or they can just simply be people who tend to be a little quirky and think outside the box. And they were very smart at the park that they did not require these square pegs that they hired to fit into round holes in order to do their work. They said, look, let the square pegs do whatever they want as long as they're getting the results. So the atmosphere was that you had this environment where it was okay to be a little weird. You could be accepted in a way that you might not be accepted on the outside. And it was a place where women spoke really fondly about the fact that their voices and their ideas would be heard in a way that they probably would not hear on the outside at their ordinary jobs. And you were finding acceptance for, you know, a number of people, for example, who are homosexual or who were a little bit on the different scale if they had, you know, they were in open marriages or so forth. There were all kinds of different people there. And there was, for the most part, acceptance. And that was something that I found was, you know, incredibly forward, you know, of the place in terms of the kind of atmosphere you want to find yourself working. So that was really the most, a little long-winded, but, you know, the most wonderful thing I found about the park was just this wonderful, quirky wonderland of a place that it really was.
I really liked that aspect of the book as well. And I texted Kayla about this as I was reading. I was like, I love this kind of like 1940s wartime Gossip Girl column that we have happening at the beginning of chapters. I was like, it's amazing.
Well, I ended up having, you know, my whole thing revolves around the fact that three very different women get recruited to the park. And, you know, in the ordinary walk of life, they would never have even met, much less become friends, but they're thrown together. And, you know, given the fact that they work in all different places in the park, which means they can't talk to each other about the work that they do, I thought, well, how can I get these women to relate to each other, you know, to bond early on when they have so little in common? And I ended up starting a literary society, and I made them all bookworms because, you know, as you know, bookworms can always talk to each other about books, even if you have nothing else you can talk about. So these women bond on their very first day when they meet, when they realize they're all reading the same book, which happens to be Vanity Fair by Thackeray, which is also about young women setting off into the world and trying to find their place. And so they then, you know, since I had already had this research that said that there were so many extracurricular societies that had popped up for, you know, people to have hobbies off shift, I decided there would be a literary society. So the girls all basically start a monthly book club, and they have such fun doing it. And I really had fun doing it. And then that grows as well into, there's sort of like a weekly anonymous gossip column, you know, just for inside the park. And I had fun with that too, because I have seen Gossip Girl, and I was thinking of that a little bit and cackling when I wrote.
I could definitely tell. I loved it. Kind of going off of this topic of research, I love a random fact. And given that you've done immense historical research over the course of your career, I'd love to know, what's the strangest historical fact you've ever learned, either from researching the Rose Code or just ever?
Oh, that's a fun one. I think one of the strange things that I did learn about, which was for this book and which I could not resist putting in, was the fact that what actually did sort of smack me between the eyes when I was first reading, and I realized that Prince Philip, you know, the royal consort, the Duke of Edinburgh, before he was the Duke of Edinburgh, and this was in the days when Princess Elizabeth is only about 13, he actually had a wartime girlfriend and a longtime, really very serious relationship with a girl who worked at Bletchley Park. And there are such cool anecdotes that I found about how, you know, she would, whenever he was in, she would write him when he was away at sea, because he was just a lieutenant in the British Navy then. And when he was in town, she would take the train to London and they would like dance all night in London nightclubs. And then he would put her on the dawn train in like her dancing dress to get back to Bletchley so she could make her morning shift in time. And I really found that was, you know, fantastically interesting and just kind of cool. And it, you know, kind of, you know, it's a fun little royal cameo. So I couldn't resist putting that in. And I have one of my heroines, whose name is Ozla, is very, very closely based on the real life Ozla Benning, who was in fact Prince Philip's wartime girlfriend and who did work at Bletchley Park as a translator.
That's a perfect segue. So I am obsessed with the royal family and their history. I'm a royal watcher. I loved reading about young Prince Philip, especially he'll be turning 100 this year. And I also loved how you, Princess Elizabeth and Margaret were very casually in the book, like they had small cameos. What made you decide to incorporate them beyond the Prince Philip connection?
Well, it also came down from my research. It was because I knew I wanted Philip in there just because, you know, history gave me that on a platter. I wasn't going to leave that out of the book. I just couldn't. So he was already there. And then there was, you know, given that I also had this post-war timeline in the Rose Code, which is where the post-war mystery is being solved in the countdown to the royal wedding of Philip and Elizabeth. And that's simply because, you know, when you are in a mad dash to catch a traitor, it may as well be on the day of a royal wedding when you can't get a cop's attention to save your life. And there are going to be so many crowds in all of the train stations that you will have a devil of a time getting anywhere on time. So I just figured that would be fun and a fun little backdrop. So therefore, the royal wedding was a countdown. And the thing was, is that I happened to read a memoir, which was written by the man that the real Ozla eventually married. And he had a really funny, wry story where he said, for one thing, my wife was incredibly lovable and beautiful, and pretty much all the men in my office were in love with her. And he said, too, that journalists were constantly poking around, trying to dig up dirt on whether there was still something between her and Philip, even though that had been over for quite a while. And this was, I thought, was the fun part, was he said, at some point before the wedding, someone at Buckingham Palace decided it would be a good idea to invite him and Ozla to tea or to a lunch or possibly cocktails, I wasn't sure, with the princesses, with Elizabeth and Margaret. Apparently, someone had the idea that, I don't know, Elizabeth was going to like cozy up to Philip's ex-girlfriend and be like, so how do I manage him? Or like, do you have any tips? It's like, I don't know who thought this was a good idea. And I don't know what was said at that lunch, but would I have liked to be a fly on the wall? So that ended up being a way that I was like, well, I can't leave that out either now that I know it happened. So I do have a scene where at a very inconvenient moment, Ozla has to drop everything and show up with her fiance at Buckingham Palace to have lunch with her ex-boyfriend's fiance, who is her own future queen, which is a whole level of uncomfortable. And I was just like, there's no way I can leave that out because it's too deliciously uncomfortable for words. And because it gives me that opportunity to have a very organic, natural cameo for both Elizabeth and Margaret. Although I really did try to, you know, be as respectful as possible. I didn't give Elizabeth any lines that she didn't actually, that weren't just pleasantries or weren't things that she had actually spoken in her life at some point. Margaret is long dead, so I put a few more, gave her a few more lines as needed, but I did try to be respectful of, you know, not have them act wildly out of character from what we know of them.
They honestly both seem so in character. The scene with Princess Margaret, I was like, this probably happened. Like, it was done so well.
Yeah, I was thinking about The Crown while I was reading that part.
Well, and you know, the other interesting thing about if you're looking for a royal connection is the fact that and I worked this into the book too, is that it was another thing that history just gave me on a plate, which was that Kate Middleton's grandmother worked at Bletchley Park, which was something that, you know, she only knew in terms of like, well, I knew she worked there, but I didn't know any of the details. And so, you know, the Duchess is now, she was the one who reopened Bletchley Park after its big renovation. She's been sort of a patron for them and, you know, visits frequently, to my understanding. So I was also able, I worked in Kate Middleton's grandmother as well as, you know, one of the Literary Society members, just because why not? We know she was there and it was kind of fun to have, again, just a little connection, because it really is quite extraordinary how many people pass through Bletchley Park. I mean, I think it was Olivia Newton-John's father worked there, you know, Ian Fleming, who, you know, later created James Bond, was in and out of there with Admiralty Intelligence. It's really amazing how many people at some point went through Bletchley Park. It employed thousands by the end of the war.
My jaw dropped when Valerie Middleton showed up because I knew who she was. And I was just like, it was like the cherry on top because I already loved the book so much. And then I actually went back and watched the videos from Kate's visits to Bletchley after. And it was so cool. She talks about how like her, she knew her grandma worked there, but she was still scared to talk about it like years and years later.
Well, that's one of the things I really, that is really just as impressive as the code breaking achievements at Bletchley Park is how secret everyone kept it. I mean, we live now in a world where it's, you know, 24-hour news cycle and everyone is updating their, what they're doing on social media every hour of the day, sometimes you think with some people. And you think like, how could a secret like that be kept nowadays? And we probably think it probably couldn't be. But back then it's literally thousands of people were just indoctrinated into Bletchley Park, you know, told we're breaking codes, grab a pencil, have at it. And oh, by the way, here's the oath of secrecy. Please sign. Never talk about this again. And they basically all said, oh, okay. And they didn't. And that even carried on after the war. And the thing about that, which I found really fascinating, was by the 70s, which is 30 years later, you had the first books about Bletchley Park start to come up. And at that point, the 30-year sort of period was of secrecy was sort of over. And so it started to be talked about more. And you did have some people who wrote books and memoirs and so forth. And I'm glad that they did. It gave me stuff that I could research. It gave it, and it gave the credit to the code breakers that they really deserve for their achievements. But even so, there were many people who, even when it started to come out about Bletchley Park, who refused to talk about it, who would say, I will never discuss what I did there. I don't consider that my oath is, you know, is over until I'm dead. Or there were some who only released information about it posthumously after their deaths. Or there were some who, you know, would talk a little bit, but not very much. And one of the wonderful things that I did find from my research was there was at least one occasion, which I think was a story came from a guide at Bletchley Park, I can't remember, where he said something like, there is a very, very old woman in a wheelchair who was being pushed through the park by her husband. And during one of the displays, she was like, she kept shaking her head and, you know, looking increasingly frustrated. And finally, she bangs her fist and she's on her wheelchair. And she says, that is not how it was. And they said, well, why? And she said, because I worked here, damn it. I worked here during the war. And her husband looks around at her also like, you know, 95 or something. And he says, really, you were hut 6? I was hut 3.
Wow.
And they realized that they had been married for something like 40 years. They had met and married after the war, and they had both worked at Bletchley Park during the war, but never crossed paths. And they had never talked about it in a very long marriage. And there is more than one couple that had that discovery. That wasn't even just a one-time thing. So no spoilers, but that kind of goes into that experience, kind of goes into the Rose Code as well, because that just seemed too good to pass up.
That's so cool.
I love that. So this is a listener question that we got for you, and it goes really well with what we're talking about. Are your female characters often inspired by real life people?
I'd say all of them are in some ways. All three of my heroines from the Rose Code are inspired by real people, or very, very closely based on real people, or who are sometimes composites of historical people. Mab, who is my London East Ender, who comes to the park with a secretarial degree and a hope, a very deep desire to sort of better her station in life with a library card and her, as much education as she can manage. She's very symbolic of a lot of the women worker bees at the park who worked a whole lot of different jobs, everything from filing to working the decoding machines and finally up to working the famous bomb machines, which were designed by Alan Turing. Then I have Ozla, who was based on, who is my, you know, Canadian born debutante, and she is based very, very closely on Ozla Benning, who was a real Canadian born debutante who did date Prince Philip. The reason I fictionalized her lightly with a different last name and a couple of different principal, a couple of different small things, is because the real Ozla, she's long dead, but she does have children who are still living. I would like to at least make the differentiation that I based it on her, but I am not saying that this is the same person as your mother, which I think is something that, you know, it becomes a question when you're writing about real people, who are public figures and who is not. Prince Philip and the royals are public figures. They have Wikipedia pages. Their lives in some degrees are public property to be written about, although I think respectfully, as I've tried to do. But someone like Ozla was a private citizen, so I therefore gave an extra layer of fictionalizing to her since she has family still living. And then for Beth, who is my third heroine, she's a shy village spinster who lives locally and is, you know, very, very much the sort who can't even look strangers in the eye when she talks to them and lives under the thumb of a very emotionally abusive family. She becomes a star cryptanalyst in her own right. And I based her on two very different women. One was Mavis Beatty, who was a real code breaker, who was an absolute brilliant brain of a woman who really did work for, she worked on an all-female team and was the brain behind some of Bletchley Park's biggest breaks. And most of her best code breaking achievements I based on Mavis's. And she also had a fantastically romantic relationship where she fell in love with a fellow code breaker who met her literally while they were, you know, breaking German codes together, and ended up together and very happy for a very long time. So that also had its part to play. And then the other person I based Beth on was a nameless woman who I found in the records who reportedly had a nervous breakdown after an affair with a married Bletchley Park colleague had gone south. And in the middle, and after her breakdown became so unreliable that she was sent to some sort of sanatorium or mental institution because it was worried that she would disclose classified information in her broken state. And I wasn't able to find out what this woman's name was or if she was released eventually from the asylum or from the institution, but that seemed like a very disquieting thing to read. And I certainly hope that the woman in question was able to be released eventually. But there's a similar path that my heroine Beth's course takes as well in the pages of the Rose Code. So, and this is the way, like, all of my characters tend to be based on real people or composites of real people.
So on the topic of Beth, she was one of my favorite parts of the book. I feel like a lot of historical fiction novels have these like beautiful debutantes, which of course the Rose Code does, but Beth is kind of an unlikely hero. She's a nerd. And as you were talking about earlier, she could have likely been diagnosed with some form of neurodivergence if she was in today's time. But she was so awesome. And I want to know why it was important for you to show a different type of woman hero in this setting.
Well, it's because I love the idea, since this is going to be a book about a mental and intellectual kind of fight rather than a physical fight, I knew that one of my women was, you know, going to be one of the cryptanalysts. And those were in the park, those are the ones who are making the breaks into the code initially. And they're doing that critical early work that needs to be done before the machines could then sort of crack it open the rest of the way, a lot of the ways. And that's the top level sort of the work that was done at Bletchley Park as far as the code breaking was concerned. And that tended to be the level where there were mostly men. There were far fewer female cryptanalysts. They tended to fill the slots a little further down the chain. And so therefore I was really interested in the women who were cryptanalysts. You mentioned The Imitation Game. Keira Knightley plays Joan Clark, who is one of the few female cryptanalysts who worked with Alan Turing. You said there's only one? Yep, that's right. It was a male team. There's one woman on it. But at Bletchley Park, I found a wonderful exception to that rule. And that was a certain scholar by the name of Dilly Knox, who was a rather very eccentric, in fact, a classics scholar who turned codebreaker and cryptanalyst And he was eccentric to all kinds of ways. He was the classic absent-minded scholar who would like lose his glasses when they were sitting on top of his head, and who would like stuff his sandwiches into his pipe instead of his tobacco, you know, when he was deep down into the wheels of, you know, code breaking. But one of his things was that he insisted on hiring only women for his code breaking team. And he made, and this wasn't because he wanted, you know, lots of pretty young women around to hit on, although there were jokes about, you know, they were called Dilly's Fillies and, you know, the harem. But he just maintained instead that women made very good code breakers because they had good attention to detail and they were less likely to bring egos into it than men. So therefore, he tended to recruit only women, and therefore he had a crack team of the best female brains at Bletchley. And these women were, you know, behind some of the biggest breaks in Bletchley Park intelligence history. They cracked the entire Italian battle plan for the Italian Navy before the Battle of Mattapan. And that, since they were able to crack that so completely, that handed Britain the biggest naval victory since Trafalgar against Napoleon. So this was the kind of achievement that his girls, his ladies, his fillies, his women were able to do. And I really wanted to pay them their due because, as I said earlier, there's been a lot written about these big male figures at the park, you know, Alan Turing, you know, then some of these sort of chess champion genius types, you know, who were, you know, the ones who were working on British, on German naval codes and so forth, but there wasn't as much about the women. And so I knew I wanted to have a woman code breaker, you know, someone who was maybe a little odd, she would be called back then, or just shy. And, but, you know, who's has a gift for crossword puzzles, who has a gift for seeing patterns, who has a mind that works for this. And so therefore that's sort of how Beth was born. And I really wanted her to, you know, be a, find a way to be the star that she was meant to be, which she couldn't find in ordinary life, but which she found there.
This is another listener question. Of the three recent books you've written, Alice Network, Huntress, and The Rose Code, which character do you resonate with the most?
Oh, that's a good one. Goodness. That's really a hard one to do because I'm not sure I'm really much like any of my heroines. I think all of them to some degree have a little bit of wish fulfillment. They have something I would like to be able to do. I would love to have Beth's code breaking ability. I'd love to have Eve's, you know, absolute steel in a bad situation or a dangerous situation. I would love to be someone like Nina who could had, who was literally could say with a straight face that she was only afraid of one thing in the entire world and who didn't have a fear of heights, because I'm the kind of person who white knuckles in a 747. But I'm not sure I'm really like, I'm really much like any of my heroines. If there's any maybe that resonates with me the most, maybe it's Ozla from the Rose Code, because I, and this is something that I have even has become even more much the case during the pandemic and during lockdown, is I cherish my friends and I worry about them. I check in on them. Even when we're a continent apart, we work together. We make sure that we're okay. And Ozla has the same gift, I think, for she worries about her friends. She cherishes them. She makes sure that she wants to make sure they're all right. She wants to pull people together. And I have a little bit of that too, even though I am an introvert and I do like my alone time, but I have had a wonderful support network of female friends in my life and colleagues and fellow authors, and I don't know where I would be without them. So I wanted this book to be very much a book about female friendship as well as about code breaking and friendship and all its complexities. And I think that's a little bit of tribute to the fact of how much I value my friends and how much you know, they value me in turn and how much I owe them.
That's so sweet. So on that same note of your past books, I actually read The Huntress last month, also loved it. And I noticed a cameo from a character from the Alice Network. The same thing happened in this book with a character from The Huntress. I freaked out both times. I really love these little Easter eggs. What made you decide to include them?
Because I'm a Marvel fan, and I always loved the whole game of, like, when is Stan Lee going to turn up when you watch a Marvel movie, which is really sad now because he can't. But I love the idea of a shared universe. And so, therefore, I love the idea of seeing if I can weave my stories together in whatever way they can be woven. And I'm shameless. I will weave in other people's stories, too. I mean, if you are a fan of Jennifer Robson's books, I actually have a cameo in The Huntress, which is from her heroine, Ruby, who writes the Goodnight from London column. Well, Jen Robson's book, Goodnight from London, has the column, and I actually have my character reading that column in a scene during the London Blitz. So that's a crossover literally from Jen Robson's books into mine. And I just wrote like a short story with my friend Stephanie Dre, where we wrote a crossover where Ian from The Huntress, who's a journalist, goes to interview her heroine from the upcoming Women of Chateau Lafayette, because we figured out they could have crossed paths. And so I love the idea of a shared universe. I would weave in all my friends' books if I could find a way to have them cross paths. And that's, I think, it's just a little bit of extra fun for me.
It's so much fun for the reader, too. And like, we read so much historical fiction. So it's like, I was saying recently on an episode, I feel like I'm reading about the real universe with World War II, but there will be all these cameos of people I learned about in a different book. So like, having an actual character was just so exciting. Also kind of on the note of your past books, we heard that the Alice Network is going to be turned into a limited series. Is there anything that you can tell us about that?
No, just that right now. Both the Alice Network and The Huntress, and actually the Rose Code as well, have all been optioned. But an option is just the first step in a very long process. So, you know, this does not mean that it's an absolute guarantee that, you know, the Bridgerton version of the Alice Network or The Huntress is popping up in your TV screen absolutely by, you know, July or whatever. It's just the first step. So therefore, you know, I hope it'll happen. You know, I cross my fingers it will, but, you know, a lot more things have to, you know, go right for that to make it to the screen. So we shall see. And I don't have any casting news, unfortunately, or anything like that I can share. I will definitely throw that up all over social media if I ever find out anything along those lines.
Well, if you could cast anyone, living or dead, in whichever character comes to mind, who would you cast?
Well, for the Rose Code, I had a lot of fun with that. I really like for Ozla, if she was being cast in a miniseries, Holiday Granger would be very good. She was in the Borgias. She's in the CB Strike series. She's like the girl who all the women want to be, but also all the men want to date, and all the women want is their best friend. She's not the mean girl, even though she's the most, you know, glamorous thing in the room. And then I think that Cara Delevingne would be very good for Mab. She's got those ferocious eyebrows, and she's got the height, and she's got a really great resting bitch face. If you've ever seen her on Carnival Row, you'll see that she's very good at playing, like, you know, the person with a very hard outer shell, but like a nice big soft heart inside. And then for Beth, I really think, like everybody else, I saw The Queen's Gambit and I just loved it. And Anya Taylor-Joy literally plays a quirky, quirky genius named Beth in that series. So I was like, right, maybe she's tired of that part, but, you know, if she's not, she could totally play Beth. Anyway, so that was a fun question to think about.
Oh, those are all so good.
Oh, those are great. Love it.
So if you could no longer write historical fiction, what genre would you choose?
Oh, goodness. What would I choose? I might write romance because I have a lot of friends who write romance. I love a good historical romance, and it's wonderful escapism. And sometimes, especially when you really need like a nice, upbeat, positive ending, which I really needed this last year, a romance is just about the best thing there is. So I might write romance. That would be fun. Or I might try to write suspense, but because I've sort of dipped my toe in those waters with The Huntress has a bit of a suspense twist, and, you know, even the Rose Code has a bit of a suspense twist too. But I will say, like, those, you know, twisty, naughty, Robert Goddard-like plots do not come easily to me. So I don't know how good I would be at writing suspense, but that is okay, because I would absolutely be writing books and just putting them in drawers if I wasn't able to publish them. So, you know, honestly, it wouldn't matter if I was any good or not. I'd still be writing them, even if I wasn't actually, even if they weren't good enough to get published or be read by anybody.
So we have another listener question. What are your essentials for a long day of writing?
Well, coffee, which I've been swigging on during our entire interview. My dogs, who, you know, are parked out all over the floor of my study, basically making sure that I have companionship while I'm writing. And a little bit of good quality dark chocolate is a nice thing to have too. And I do need music. I tend to rely on a lot of movie soundtracks, you know, stuff that will theme into whatever it is that I'm writing. For the writing of The Rose Code, I had the soundtracks for the movie Enigma, for the movie The Imitation Game, from the movie Dunkirk, from Darkest Hour. There are so many great World War II movies with fantastic soundtracks. I had all of them, I swear, on repeat while I was writing this. So I really love having music in the background, and I really need it. I can't work in silence. So,
ooh, now I want to reread it with those soundtracks playing. Yeah.
Well, I do have a Spotify playlist that I put together for The Rose Code, which was a lot of fun because I have a couple tracks from the writing from Enigma, and I have from the movie soundtrack Enigma. I have a couple tracks, all the tracks that are mentioned in the book, because a number of songs are mentioned by title in the book. I have the fanfare that was actually written for the real Princess Elizabeth's wedding. And, you know, I have all the music that appears there, and a good amount of the music that I was writing to as well. So if you want to check it out on Spotify, look it up, and you will see there's a nice playlist that will go with the reading of The Rose Code if you have a book club.
Oh, that's so cool. So on that note, kind of, if you had to create a custom cocktail or mocktail for The Rose Code, what would it be?
I have already done this, and it is delicious, I will tell you. Essentially, you get a champagne flute, top it to about the 2/3 mark with champagne or Prosecco or whatever your favorite bubbly is. Bonus points if it's pink. Put in a shot to 2 shots of vodka, depending on how strong you like your cocktails. Add a few drops of rose water. You can get that usually at like specialty shops or Wegmans, things like that. You have to be sparing with the rose water. It's very strong. You don't want to end up like you're drinking perfume. So add a few drops and then sort of like adjust the proportions to taste. And then a little bit of a few drops of lemon juice as well to cut it if it's too sweet. And then top with a rose petal and drink. And it's a Rose Code cocktail, and it's lovely.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I love that. Are you working on anything right now? And is there anything you can tell us about it?
Yes, actually, I just finished drafting my first draft of the novel, the next novel after The Rose Code. It is tentatively titled The Diamond Eye, and it is about history's most famous and successful female sniper in history. And this was a woman, her name was Lyudmila Pavlichenko. She was a single mother, a budding historian, a grad student with the world's most deadly dull dissertation topic. And she ended up, when her country was invaded by Hitler, she joined the army, and she ended up becoming a sniper with 309 on her tally. And not only was this, you know, an incredible enough story on its own, but she was sent on a goodwill tour of the United States in 1942, where she just happened to become BFFs with none other than Eleanor Roosevelt. So I was thinking, I couldn't believe this had not already had some kind of big screen treatment, a big novel treatment, whatever. But I was glad it hadn't, because I was like, I have to tell this story. I have to tell this incredible woman's story. So the next book is The Diamond Eye, and it's about Lyudmila Pavlichenko, whose nickname, as if her life was not badass enough, her nickname was Lady Death.
Oh my God. Wow. I can't wait to read this.
Yeah, that sounds so good.
Well, I really can't wait to share that one. And I just finished drafting the first draft and a first round of edits, when I had to sort of push all of that to the back and let my critique partners have it so that I could deal with the coming out of The Rose Code. Because it's that weird thing about the publication schedule, is that by the time a book comes out, I've been done with it for months and months. And then I'm being asked, what did you do? What was the research like? And I'm like, I'm damned if I can remember. I'm on to another book now at this point. You want to hear about that one?
We definitely do.
Back in the vault and have, try to remember all the things about the book that is technically just hitting stands, but which I've been actually done with for quite a while. So it's just a long process, you know, to print things and get them through all the various stages of editing. So that's what it is. So it's fun to get to always have the question at the end about what are you working on next? Because that's actually really what I am working on now.
Right. Yeah.
What can we expect next? I guess we should rephrase.
Yes.
So at the end of every episode, we go around and say a book that we want to read next. So is there anything you're reading right now and loving, or anything that's on your radar that you're excited about?
Well, I just read the wonderful Yellow Wife by Sadika Johnson. That was a fantastic book. And equally good, one of my first and best reads of this year was Melanie Benjamin's The Children's Blizzard. And for one that I have read, but I think most people have not yet, because getting advanced books is one of my favorite things, is one of my favorite perks of this job. And having so many friends who are writers, because I help them with their books and they help me with mine, is Stephanie Dre's upcoming The Women of Chateau Lafayette, which is going to hit stands at the end of March and which is going to completely blow people away.
I'm so excited to read that one. We have an e-galley and I'm like ready to get to it.
Well, that one, I think it's genius because it's three, it's, you know, the whole idea of three women and three wars, but it's three women who are all revolving in three different, practically three different centuries, or at least three different times. You have a woman who is in the French Revolution, the Marquis de Lafayette's wife. You have a woman who is a New York socialite turned, you know, champion crusader in the middle of World War I. And then you have a woman, an orphan who grew up at the Chateau de Lafayette in the middle of World War II, which became a hotbed of resistance activity. And all of this comes from history, and it all revolves around one castle and three women and this legacy that they carry with them for what freedom and democracy really mean throughout the centuries. And it's a wonderful thing to unpack.
So exciting. So where can our listeners find you online if you want to be found?
Oh, you can always find me. I'm usually procrastinating from my word count on Facebook. My author page is at Kate Quinn Author. Ditto on Twitter at Kate Quinn Author. And then I'm also on Instagram. It's just Kate Quinn 5975, I think it is. And you can always find me there. I tend to post a fair amount just when I'm generally speaking, trying to get away from my to-do list. But it's social media is a wonderful way to connect. So you can always find me on there.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really fun.
Oh, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
And everybody can check on in the show notes for the links to all of the things that Kate just mentioned, including where you can buy the Rose Code. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And everybody have a great day.